There's a little saying that I've heard, that I've said sometimes, which goes, mindfulness is really easy. What's difficult is to remember to do it. And it's true that mindfulness is pretty easy, but sometimes it's deceptively easy, in that we don't see how easy it is. We often want to make it more complicated than it seems like it actually is. A moment of mindfulness is all it is a simple moment of recognition. Recognition, this is what's happening now. That's all it is. This is what's happening now. And if you hear it that simply as that, it doesn't seem like it should warrant being the central religious practice of your life. For some of you, just simply recognizing this is what's happening. That's all. Mindfulness is simple recognition of what's happening, and it can be so. It can cut through so much complication to realize that, because we often want to look ahead of ourselves and look beyond and look, you know, there must be something deeper to attain or some deeper thing to get or some get to the root of my neurosis or get to the root of some difficulty or if I really understand it then. The what then mind is often talked about in our tradition. The mind that says, if only then, if only then, the if only mind. If only this was a little bit different, if only my knees didn't hurt, then I could be mindful, but I can't be mindful of my knees hurting. Not recognizing that the very act of recognizing your knees hurt is a moment of mindfulness. If only my mind would be quiet, then I can be mindful. Not noticing that the very act of recognizing the mind is distracted, that is a moment of mindfulness right there. If only I wasn't so confused. Not noticing that the recognition of confusion is the moment of mindfulness. And somehow the trust, the power of just simply recognizing this is what's happening now. So it's hard to remember to do that because we get caught up so much. But there's another thing that could be said, and that is that mindfulness is easy. What's difficult is the continuity of it, to do it continuously. And we could wake up for a moment to what's happening, recognizing what's happening in a non-reactive way. The recognition of mindfulness is a non-reactive recognition of what's happening. It's simply seeing what's there, seeing my confusion, seeing my knee pain, seeing my distracted mind, seeing my delight and my joy. Just seeing it without coloring it with desire or aversion, without wanting it to be different in some neurotic way, kind of grasping and clinging onto it. Just seeing it for what it is in its bare simplicity, in its glory of just that one phenomenon that's occurring. But then we can maybe get a glimpse for a moment, and then we get swept back up into the currents of our thinking, of our preoccupations, and our emotional thought complexes that we get swept up in. So one of the real important aspects of mindfulness practice is not just simply understanding what the practice is. And sometimes it can take a few years for a person to actually, they think they're doing the practice before they realize that they know what it is, because you know, it has to be something more than just simply recognizing what's happening right now. I mean, what good is that? I've been recognizing stuff all my life, and that's why I'm so miserable. So to recognize how simple the practice is really, you know, key. But the next thing is to develop a continuity of doing that, a continuity over time. Because to be awake in a simple moment of recognition is not the same thing as being awake in liberation, to be really released. To be really released is to have all the different forces within us of clinging released. And it's possible to have some real clarity of recognition of this is what's happening right now. But it's only at, maybe you could say, at one layer, one level of our psyche. And at a deeper level of our psyche, we're clinging to, for example, the person who's doing the recognizing. There's very clear seeing, but I'm the one who's seeing. I'm the one who's recognizing it. And there's a very subtle clinging to that. And so the continuity of mindfulness helps us to begin dissolving all the different corners and subtleties and roots of clinging, of holding in our psyche, so that finally the psyche can be set free, that there can be this freedom, this release from all that binds it. So the continuity is what does it. The continuity is kind of if the mindfulness is like a light to on a lighthouse, the continuity is that it keeps the searchlight on all the time, so as it scans the horizon, it can light up everything and nothing is left in the dark. So the continuity is very important. In mindfulness practice, I think the word continuity works very well. We're just simply trying to develop the continuity of mindfulness over time, so moment after moment after moment, we just do this recognition of this is what's happening now. And what's quite beautiful about this recognition practice is a lot of things can occur to us as we're sitting. A lot of feelings, a lot of emotions, a lot of thoughts, a lot of body sensations. And we don't have to get involved in analyzing it and fixing it and deciding it should be something different. All we're asked to do is to kind of allow those things to happen, but in the midst of that, clearly recognize that they're happening. And to do that with continuity. Another way of talking about continuity, which is much more the classic way of talking about it in Buddhism, is to use the word concentration. To couple the mindfulness with ability to stay concentrated. To begin to have a concentrated focus into what's happening in the present moment. And concentration requires the continuity and requires a strength of mindfulness that begins seeing deeply into this is what's happening right now. Because we all know that we can recognize what's happening, but it can also be very much mixed up in our ideas about what's happening, our interpretations, our concepts we overlay it with. And so for the classic example that my teacher in Burma liked to use was if you take a wand with a torch on the end, like a little flame, and you make a big arc with it pretty fast, what the eye will see is a circle. But we know that flame is only in one place at a time. It's not a continuous circle, but it's only in one place at a time. It's kind of an optical illusion, in a sense, for us to see a circle. And so we say, oh, that's a circle. But it's not really a circle. If the concentration is really strong, I've been told that there are some film producers who can actually see each frame of a movie as it flashes on top of the, on the screen. And they see it just one frame after the other very fast. But for most of us who are not trained, we see, you know, these people up there, you know, kissing and fighting or whatever they do. And it seems very continuous to us. So as the continuity of mindfulness gets stronger, the ability to kind of see clearly and penetrating what's happening each moment drops below the level of the concepts and ideas we have of what's happening. For example, if what you recognize in the present moment is I am discouraged, well, that's fair enough to say that's what you're recognizing. But what you don't see in that statement or in that recognition is that there's a lot of overlaying the raw experience with interpretation or concepts. The grossest one is I that's happening. There's an I that's having this experience. Of course it's happening to you, but to posit an I is actually extra. It's not needed. And it adds, it's a magnet. As soon as you say I, it's a magnet for all these other associations of what I is supposed to be about. And even the idea of being discouraged, what is that? If you're sitting here, and what's happening in the moment, in and of itself, is that you're trying to be present for the breath, the mind wanders away, you notice that, you come back to the breath, you stay with the breath, the mind wanders away, you come back to the breath, the mind wanders away. And it happens, say it happens, you know, maybe 99,000 times. And after a while you notice this is happening pretty often. oh, this is a regular phenomenon. So you go, oh, this is a recognition. Oh, this is regular. It's happening a lot. And then comes the idea, oh, but the person next to me hasn't moved in 3 hours. I bet that person hasn't missed one breath for 3 hours. I think that's the ideal. That's what's supposed to be happening to me. I think I'll try harder. I'll strive. And then we strive harder. And then our mind even goes away even faster. And then we conclude, I'm not doing it right, because I'm supposed to be doing it this way, but I'm not, actually, so this is what's happening. And since it's not happening as it's supposed to be happening, I must be a failure. And because I'm a failure, I'm discouraged. Because I, myself, am a failure. I hope no one notices that I haven't been with my breath for the last 3 minutes. So we add these layers of interpretations on top of it. All that's happening is, in the raw, simple recognition, is I'm present with the breath, I'm wandering away, I notice it, I come back. It's like a yo-yo. You do it over and over again. That's all that's happening. But sooner or later, the mind will assign meaning to that, will interpret it, and compare it to ideals and shoulds and other situations, other people. As the mindfulness becomes more continuous, more concentrated, it tends to cut through all those layers of interpretation that we add on top of the experience. And we can just see all that's happening in the present moment is here's a human being who's sometimes with the breath and sometimes not. That's simple. So it makes some sense to say, you know, to recognize I am discouraged. It's really happening. But as the concentration gets stronger, we see below that and see the edifice that little statement is built on. Does that make sense what I'm saying? So the continuity is a really important part of mindfulness. In mindfulness practice, I like the word continuity more than concentration. So to develop continuity over time, not simply just to wake up for a moment, but then to stay woken up over time. One of the most pragmatic tools in Buddhism for developing continuity is to use the breath as the focal point of mindfulness practice. The breath is more or less continuous. It's more or less always there for us. And so to train the mind to stay in the present moment in a continuous fashion on the continuity of the breath develops that muscle of the mind of continuity, the muscle of mind of concentration. So to stay, not just simply, you know, to check in with each in-breath and each out-breath for a moment, but to stay there for the full length of the inhalation, the full length of the exhalation, to rest in it, to sense it, to feel it, to receive the whole thing, whatever language you like. And to use the mindfulness of the breath as a guide to help you notice when you kind of wander off into your thoughts. And to simply notice that and notice the kind of like leaning into or that holding on to some concern and then let go of it and come back to the breath. And continue to develop the continuity on the breath. As the continuity gets stronger on the breath, then it becomes something very useful that you can use to look at other things, to look at your emotions, to look at whatever's going on. There are three ways, I like to say, of developing concentration. One way is by accident, which happens to many of us. So just kind of everything, all the conditions seem right. We had enough rest and didn't eat too much food and temperature's just right. And for some strange reason, we left ourselves alone for a few minutes. And then, poof, wow, this is great. I'm really concentrating. So by accident. The other way is through an act of real effort to develop concentration. And the usual way to do that in Buddhism is to choose one object, one particular thing that you're not going to leave no matter what. And people have a very highly developed sense of will, or a certain kind of power of willpower, can sometimes do the one point of concentration very effectively. The third way of developing concentration, which is more the style of mindfulness, is you develop it on whatever keeps you from being concentrated. So, say I'm trying to follow my breath, and the knee starts hurting. Rather than thinking the knee is then a distraction, we bring our attention to the knee until that's no, you know, and develop the concentration on that difficulty or that pain, or that, those strong sensations. And then if something else occurs, if some emotion arises, we turn and use a meditative, concentrated attention to really focus carefully on this thing. So that object then becomes another excuse for developing concentration. And one of the things we're doing is using the whatever arises in mindfulness as a kind of the is it called the whetstone for sharpening a knife? Sharpening stone? Whetstone. And so whatever's arising, we're using that as an excuse, as an ability to develop the continuity. This is a very different kind of way of thinking than most people have. Most people, when something arises within them, a feeling, a body sensation, a thought, or whatever, it's like, oh, this is something I need to evaluate, this is something I need to judge, something I need to engage myself in, something I need to solve and fix and manipulate and do something with. In mindfulness, we don't have to do that. It's a lot simpler. It's just the convenient, it's like the convenient whetstone that's presented itself. Okay, I'll use this to develop this continuity, my concentration. So continuity is very important, and this is one of the things that we're developing as we do mindfulness practice, the continuity of awakefulness through time, so we can start seeing more and more clearly. So the Buddha had a teaching called the Four Roads to Success, or the Four Roads to Power, which were meant to be teachings on how to support us in developing continuity or concentration. And I thought I would tell you this: these four things. The word is, the Pali word is iddhipada, and iddhi, for our purposes, kind of means power. So the four roads to power, four roads to success in meditation practice and developing concentration. And these are the four supports for concentration, four supports for continuity. And the four are, well, the Pali words are chanda, virya, citta, and vimamsa. Chanda is usually translated as desire, virya as effort, and citta as intention, and vimamsa as investigation. So desire, effort, intention, and investigation. So the first one is desire. The word is chanda. Now, just a little footnote to here. There's a lot of confusion in Buddhist circles because it's common in English for people to translate the second noble truth, the cause of suffering, as desire, which is not really the literal translation. The literal translation is clinging, is thirst, is kind of a clinging thirst. It's a distinction maybe between a clinging and holding. You can hold something quite peacefully and you can also cling to it, take a life out of it. You can have a desire and you can thirst or be addicted or be demanding of what, you know, you can have this great neurotic need for something to occur. The Buddha never, as far as I know, criticized all desire. He just criticized or was pointed to the fact that there's this neurotic desire, this clinging desire, which can cause a lot of suffering. And he used the word chanda when he wanted to refer to kind of neutral desire, which doesn't necessarily cause any suffering. And here, as the desire connected to wholesome practice, is that there has to be a desire for practice. And that desire needs to be uncomplicated, needs to be simple, it needs to be not connected to expectation, demand, fear, clinging. It needs to just kind of be almost a natural wish. You know, if it's possible to be hungry and desire food, and it's a very simple desire. Then if you get really hungry and really, really hungry and kind of headachy, then it gets kind of, the desire has a very different flavor perhaps. But just a very simple wish. I'd like to have this. The desire for practice is a very important desire. And it is not meant to be avoided, but to actually be respected very deeply. I think this is kind of my own peculiarity. You can do with this as you wish. But I think of the desire for liberation, the desire for release, as being a biological desire. It's sort of like a biological imperative for us to practice. And what I mean by this is that if you make a very hard fist with your hand, and those of you who have never done this with me can do it, those of you who have done it many times can not. You make a really hard fist with your hand, really as hard as you, almost so it hurts, or so it hurts somewhat, and then hold it for a while, what you'll notice is that there's a natural tendency, or a tendency there in that hand, to want to relax a little bit. Because it's, you have to add a certain willpower, a certain desire. You have to kind of renew the impulse regularly to keep the fist really tight. If it's really tight, really clinging hard. And there's almost like a natural imperative, a natural desire. It's what my hand most wants to do, is to relax a little bit. It wants to relax that clinging. In the same way, the clingings within us that cause us our suffering, what they most want to do is to relax, is to release. If you could just get out of their way and not interfere with them, they would relax. They would release. Just like if you stopped insisting on your hand being tight in a fist and stopped reminding yourself, I have to remember to tighten up here because it's released a teeny bit. If you stopped doing that, the hand would just find itself released. So the desire to practice can be that simple. It's just a very simple biological imperative, I call it. It's a biological imperative for release. Or another analogy would be a really wound up tight spring. What that spring most wants to do is to unwind. All you have to do is to pull the plug or something, you know, and it just unwinds. Or a bathtub, right? You know, what you have a bathtub full of water, in a sense, you can say, maybe, if you're, is that what the water most wants to do is to go down the drain. And all you need to do is to pull the plug, you know, down it goes. What our inner life most wants is to be released, to be unwound, to flow into gravity, in a sense. So there doesn't have to be any idealism, any wonderful goal in mind, any wonderful metaphysics, wonderful supernatural cosmic ideas of what spirituality is. You don't have to understand some notion of God or some notion of the ultimate or some notion of the ultimate purpose of human life. You don't have to kind of have all these ideas which people tend to infuse their spirituality with. All you have to do is to be sensitive to the fact that there's a kind of urge, natural biological urge inside of us to be released. You're welcome to do all the other stuff, but don't do that in the way that gets in the way of this natural desire for release, to stop clinging. So the desire can be that simple. The desire can be so simple, just the desire to be released, to be freed of all this. And at times in our life, that desire can feel like an imperative. It feels like it's really necessary to follow through on this desire. It can even occasionally feel like we have no other choice. And it's not necessarily neurotic or not necessarily fear-based. It's just that somehow the conditions have gotten, the sensitivity has become strong enough that we really feel, really intimately, this natural desire, in a sense, of the clinging to release itself, to let go. Now there may be other desires that connect to our wish to do a spiritual practice, and some of them might deserve a lot of serious investigation. Maybe they're not very useful desires, and some of them might be. One of the preeminently beautiful desires that fuels some people's spiritual life and practice is not this biological urge for release, but rather it's compassion for others, or compassion for everyone, including oneself. the recognition that there's a lot of suffering in the world, and somehow wanting to address that suffering through their own practice. And so the motivation for practice comes from wanting to somehow be of service to the world in the suffering of the world. And that's beautiful. That, I think, also arises out of the sensitivity. It's also kind of a biological imperative, if you allow me the word, expression. It's a biological imperative because we feel the sense of connectedness to others. We feel empathetically the suffering of the world. And it's almost as if the feeling for a parent and their child. If the child hurts, the parent picks them up. It's like, you know, that's what happens. I don't know why the world was put together that way, but that's the way the world was put together. That's what you do. So in the same way, as the sensitivity becomes more developed, I think the sense of empathy and the sense of connectedness to others can be a tremendous source of motivation for practice. So the desire to alleviate suffering for others can be a powerful motivation for practice. So the desire to be free, the desire to be released, that desire is then a support for the practice of continuity. There has to be that desire. There has to be a desire to practice. There's no real desire, or no acceptance of the desire, or no allowing for that desire, or no, in a sense, respecting or even feeding that desire, then, you know, why bother? You know, we come to sit for one day sitting, and if that desire is not clear, if it's kind of like, well, I heard it was a good idea, my neighbor said it was a good idea to come and sit, you know, and so my neighbor, you know, well, I don't know, he makes nice pies, and, you know, and I was always wondered why he makes such nice pies, and, well, he tells me I should go sit, so maybe I should go sit, it'd be a good idea, and maybe I can make nice pies too. Or I don't know what you think, but people can come and, you know, kind of for all kinds of reasons that are not really connected to a real solid connected desire. And then they come here and they're kind of confused. Why am I here? You know, I mean, I could be doing something more interesting today. I mean, maybe I could do day trading. You know, or something, you know, if it has much greater value. And but it's Saturday, I think there. So to really appreciate and reflect on our desire for practice, I think is a valuable thing to do. I think all of us know that it's really easy to have your desire for practice, your desire for liberation, your desire connected to practice, get in the way of your practice. There can be, of course, neurotic desire. There can be desire which is coupled with expectation, with demand, with shoulds and shouldn'ts. A lot of ways in which our desires can get complicated. But the fact that our desires can get complicated doesn't mean that we're supposed to avoid all desire, which is what some teachers might say. There needs to be some really desire that gets us on the cushion. So the first thing is desire, appreciating our desire, and maybe spending some time getting to know it and reflecting on it. And it might take a long time hanging out with your desire, recognizing your desire, finding out what it is, before you can find the purity of it. But I think you can find a purity of desire at the heart of it, and it's well worth finding it. And there's a lot of inspiration for practice out of the purity of desire. So the second of these roads to power is effort. And maybe I shouldn't say this, but it's just a kind of footnote, etymological footnote that will just maybe cause more problems than good. But the word in Pali, in Sanskrit, is virya. And that's a direct cognate, direct kind of etymological connection with the Latin word virile. So maybe that doesn't seem so good. But anyway, virya means effort or energy in Pali and Sanskrit. And there has to be some effort involved in practice. Some energy has to be put out. Some effort has to be produced. And some I've heard some practitioners define that one of the most important areas of their practice, that they're kind of, you know, almost the definition of their practice, is just basically finding out what right effort is and negotiating between too much effort and too little effort and finding out what's the right level of effort that we need to engage ourselves in. I call it the art of effort, because there's no real clear way. You know, I can't just tell you, you know, this is the amount of effort, you know. On the scale of 1 to 10, you're supposed to do 5. You know, okay, go to work. Effort is an art, and the amount of effort that you apply in your practice is not fixed. It depends on all kinds of surrounding issues and what's going on. If you're sleepy, you might need to apply more effort to stay present. If you're really agitated, you might need to apply a lot less effort. If you're striving too much, you need to back off. If you're too complacent, you need to add effort. So, and the way we find right effort is by being off, which is the good news. Rather than beating yourself up for being off, it's like, oh, that didn't quite work, so let me try a little bit this, let me try a little bit that, a little bit more effort, a little bit less effort, and find my way. But effort is a... and there's many different kinds of effort in a spiritual practice, spiritual life. And I think it's very important to recognize that there's different kinds, because sometimes when we talk about effort, we're talking about one particular area where effort applies. It doesn't necessarily apply to others, but we're so quick to generalize and assume it's supposed to be this way all the time. So, for example, there might be some teachers who might say, you're not supposed to make any effort when you sit and practice. You're supposed to sit here and practice and just relax and not make any effort and let the natural unfolding just happen on its own. There might be a lot of wisdom to that, but what was neglected to be noticed, perhaps, is that it took a lot of effort to get here today, to get on the cushion. You had to get up in the morning, you had to kind of get ready, you had to make your lunch, you had to get in your car, you had to buy gas to get here, you had to do all this stuff, you know, and to get here. And some of you came from far away to come here today, and it's a lot of effort to come here. A lot of effort to get to a place where you're not supposed to do and make any effort. It's, you know, kind of a little bit of a paradox, right? You're supposed to come here just you're supposed to come and just to kind of accept things as they are. You know, you could have done that in Santa Cruz. You know, you come here, you do all this work to get here. So it's quite appropriate to put in the effort to get yourself on the cushion, and sometimes that takes more effort than others. I went to Asia. It was a lot of effort to get to Asia. It was, in my situation, it was appropriate to do that, to put in that effort to get there. Once we sit on the cushion, then there's a different kind of effort. Maybe there's still different levels of effort that are required. There's the effort, for example, to sit and sit upright. It takes effort to sit upright. It takes less effort to lay down flat on the floor. If we wanted to say, you know, this practice is about applying no effort at all and let the natural unfolding happen by itself. Well, okay, lay down. We'll all do a laying down practice then. It's much better, more conducive, because there's a certain amount of effort that goes into keeping your body upright. But actually, it's very valuable to keep your body upright. That the amount of effort it takes to have an upright, alert posture and not slump too much is actually very helpful. So there's that effort. The physical effort of sitting upright. And then there's the effort of what do you do with your mind, with your attention? So there's the effort of applying ourselves, applying the attention to what you want to pay attention to. And there's different things you can pay attention to. Today I was mostly encouraging you to pay attention to the breath. And it takes some effort to direct the mind to the breath. And if the mind is very scattered and distractible and distracting, then you have to kind of match the energy of the distractibility with an effort, a counter effort of staying with the breath. And sometimes it might take a tremendously strong effort to really stay with the breath. I can imagine someone actually applying such strong effort occasionally, very occasionally, that they might even break into a sweat because they're really fixed. I'm going to stay here on this breath. I'm not going to let myself wander one moment. And it might even be a kind of tense effort. But I don't know if necessarily all tense efforts should be wrong. It's a matter of where you are in the scale, where you are in the context of stuff. If you're really agitated, maybe that's really helpful occasionally to really make that kind of strong effort. As the mindfulness gets stronger, as the concentration gets stronger, and as the forces of distraction get weaker, the forces of the hindrances get weaker, as we learn to recognize what distracts us and learn how to relate to it more wisely and not get caught by it, then the effort needed to practice becomes lighter and lighter, easier and easier. And at some point, the effort to practice is defined as effortless effort. We don't have to apply any effort for the effort to be there. I don't know if this is the right analogy or comparison, but there are times when I've taken up running, and in the first days of taking up a pattern of running, the first 100 yards, 1,000 yards or something, I just intensely dislike it. I mean, there's all this resistance, you know, my God, this is the most, and then my mind is, you know, has all these rationalizations why I shouldn't be doing it. And it's really hard, like, you know, it's like working against, you know, quicksand or something. And I have to put a lot of effort, I have to overcome the resistance. And then after those first 1,000 yards or something, then somehow the resistance dissolves or something, I don't know what happens physiologically, but then it becomes a lot easier to run for a while at least. Maybe another 1,000 yards. And so as we get into the swing of running and we get into shape, we can say, it becomes more effortless to run. Effortless running, because it seems to be just happening on its own. We don't have to overcome the resistance or anything. The same thing with sitting. After some point, it becomes effortless effort. And it's very important to learn how to back off and give a chance for the effortless effort to happen. It's such a mystery. It's such a huge topic, the topic of effort. Some people who find themselves very agitated or very distracted or very wound up, it's not the right instruction to say, make really strong effort to stay with the breath no matter what. The right instruction for them at that particular time is actually to say, don't make any effort. Just get out of, completely out of the way. And just sit here and don't even try to concentrate the mind on anything. And that kind of instruction just allows the mind to unwind by itself. And then the mind unwinds and gets more and more calm and settled. And once it's calm and settled, then maybe we apply a certain effort to our attention. So the attention becomes more focused, to focus more carefully on different things you can pay attention to. So the unfortunate thing is that there's no one thing that I can tell you of how you should apply effort in your practice. Sometimes no effort should be applied, just relax and just let the relaxing happen. Sometimes make a really dynamic effort. Sometimes it's make a little bit of effort, a little bit of letting go, a little bit of both. And it can sound very complicated. It feels complicated to me as I say all this. I apologize. But the fact is that each of us has to negotiate this issue by themselves. What's the right effort? But there has to be some effort. But are you doing too much effort or too little effort? What's going on here for you? Some people need to do more effort, but of a different kind. Maybe they have plenty of effort, that's striving effort. And striving effort will just get in your way. There should be no striving in this practice. So that's kind of a, maybe sounds like a paradox, or I'm contradicting myself. There can be desire, there can be effort and engagement, but you're not supposed to strive. Striving has a quality of clinging, of demanding. Things have to be a certain way. The natural desire doesn't need any outcome. When you, the water that wants to go down the drain, you know, really wants to go down the drain. But if you put the plug in the bathtub again, the water doesn't care. The gravity is still there. So in the same way for us, there can be the desire for it. It's almost like the pull of gravity, but there's no demand for it. So there needs to be effort, and effort is a very important aid to the continuity. The third is intent. The third road to power, or road to continuity, is intention. Intent. So it's one thing to have the desire. It's another thing to have kind of in the background energy available. But there also needs to be intent. There needs to be... Intent is a little bit different than desire, because intent is manifested desire. Intention is desire which is followed through on, which gives birth to motivation. There has to be motivation. There has to be motivation for that energy. That energy has to be channeled by a certain intentness. So to be intent on what we're doing here. This is what I'm doing. So some teachers will give a guided meditation of sitting like a mountain in this great stable. Especially works well when you're sitting on the floor. But to sit like a mountain, to give student a sense of how to sit with great intent, to kind of plant oneself. This is where I'm going to sit. I'm going to sit here with great intent to really let this desire, let this effort really apply myself to it. This is what intent has, the quality, has the effect of weeding out all these other things in life we could be doing. There's so much we could do, and one of the great difficulties of, I think, people in the modern American life, especially here around where we live, there seems to be so many demands and so many possibility of things we can do that no one has time to do them all. And so a lot of people get themselves all worked up at all these different things they're supposed to be doing. And then a spiritual life can just be like one of many things. But there has to be a real intent that can clarify what's really important for us. So that maybe we realize that day trading isn't that high priority for us. Or whatever it might be that, you know. And there's some things that might be quite wonderful to do. And maybe, you know, and if you could live to be 1,000 years old, or there was a 14-day week, you know, it's fine to fit them in. But we, as human beings, we live limited lives. And we have to be very honest about the fact that our lives are limited. We don't have unlimited amount of energy and time to do everything. So can there be a real intent, a serious resolve? Oh, this is really important for me, and I'm going to follow this through. This is going to be the intention. Intention is kind of like the rudder on a ship that sets the course. You set the rudder in a certain direction, the boat will go in that direction. And so you set the intent. Well, this is what I'm going to do. This is the direction I'm going to go. And I'm going to let this be the organizing principle of the rest of my life. So for some people, spirituality is the most central thing of their life. And it's the central organizing principle. Or they want it to be. And it's really valuable to spend some time thinking about that and reflecting on it. How can I follow through on this intent in this limited life that I have? For other people, maybe it's not the central organizing principle, but it's one of the important ones. But if your spiritual life is just one in the 10,000 things that are important, if it has no more importance in your life than watching, is it Millionaire? Is that what this program's called? I haven't seen it. What's it called? Those who were, you can be a millionaire? What? I want to be a millionaire? But I'm talking to people who don't know what modern culture is about. This is one of the most important television programs of the year, and you don't know? My God, who am I with here? I haven't seen it, but I just read a little article in the newspaper it's one of these game shows, right, where you can win $1 million if you, I guess, answer the right questions. And it's so popular that they announce 3 nights a week, and it's so popular that they want to do more nights a week. Imagine just watching other people become millionaires five nights a week. So I can imagine that, you know, it's a useful thing for human life to do that, but if your spiritual life is just, you know, in that category, you know, one of those kinds of things, you know, you kind of, that's a good idea to do, and you know, you're not going to get very far. There needs to be an intent. If you want to make a fire by rubbing sticks together, if you rub them 3 or 4 times and then take a break, you know, and come back, you know, get a glass of water or something, and then come back 10 minutes later and start again, rub another 4 or 5 times. Well, this is getting a bit much. I think, you know, I'll come back a little bit later. You'll never make a fire because you have to maintain the rubbing over a long enough time, enough continuity of rubbing to build up the heat to create a spark. So the same thing with meditation practice. The continuity is really important, and you need to have that continuity that builds the inner development, builds the release. So the continuity can happen through daily sitting. On a retreat like today, the continuity can be really disrupted at lunchtime. If you decided to go at lunchtime and go to some local restaurant and catch up with an old friend who lives in town you haven't seen for a while, and you know, chat it up for that hour and then come back at the end, you'll find the continuity has been interrupted and you're basically starting over again. But if you're really careful during lunchtime and maintain the silence, the continuity then continues. And that continuity is really, really helpful. The last of these iddhipadas is investigation. Investigation is a very, very important element of mindfulness practice, and it's kind of almost a twin sibling to mindfulness. Mindfulness just recognizes what's there, but investigation is that quality of mind that wants to look more carefully. Now that I recognize this is here, let me look more closely at this. Let me get to know this better. Not to analyze it or to figure it out, but to feel my way into it more carefully. To notice what's happening here. And it can happen at very kind of global or abstract levels of our reactivity, and to very subtle. If someone near us, if someone comes into the meditation hall and slams the door, and you recognize that, you might spend the next couple of minutes with great justification, you know, wondering how this person can be so mindless and so disrespectful to go around slamming doors in a quiet meditation hall. This quality of investigation would be to be more interested in what's going on with me here. What's happening inside of me? What's the sense of... What happened when that door slammed? What's the feelings? What are the judgments? What are the reactions? What's really going on for me? So an inequality investigation is to look back at ourselves rather than to assign blame somewhere else. That's at a very kind of abstract level. But if you have strong physical pain, for example, in the sitting, is to go in there with mindfulness and investigate that pain. Get to know it really for what it is. And it's fascinating with pain, because pain from a distance can seem so solid, like a permanent solid fixture. And if you bring really careful mindfulness to investigate it, you see what makes up the pain is different sensations arising and passing. Arising and passing. If the sensation of pain is arising and passing, who are you in that moment, in that fraction of a moment, when it's passed and before it arises again? Who are you? What is it? What's going on here? What is, if it's arising and passing each moment, what's your relationship to it? And if you look really deeply into physical pain, it doesn't become pain. It becomes just intense sensations, intense vibration that rises and passes. And it's fascinating to do that kind of investigation. To investigate our reactions, our responses, to investigate more carefully what's actually happening, but to do it in a way, to investigate. Another very important quality of investigation is to investigate the quality of the attention that's investigating. Does that make sense? To investigate the quality of your attention. Because are you paying attention in a way that's straining? Are you paying attention in a way that's hoping for some results? Are you paying attention in such a way, you know, driven by fear, or driven by hope, or driven by desire or greed? Are you driven? Is it a drivenness? Or is it quite relaxed, as if nothing actually needs to happen? Because in mindfulness, it's best to have the attitude, nothing needs to happen. And in that spirit that nothing needs to happen, we develop the strength of our mindfulness. The only thing that needs to happen is your mindfulness gets stronger. Mindfulness gets more continuous. What you're mindful of doesn't have to change. That's the really good news and bad news. Bad news, because most of us want things, we want something to change. It's a very, very powerful strategy in spiritual life to simply develop the mindfulness to become stronger and stronger. It's like this, it's like mindfulness, as the mindfulness is this, in and of itself is this moment of liberation. To simply recognize in the simplicity of the moment, this is what's happening, is a moment of liberation. And then as the continuity and concentration develop, that moment of liberation expands out and relaxes the tensions which are just beyond its boundaries, and it gets bigger, and it relaxes the next tensions, and it relaxes the next, and moves out, and moves out, and finally there's no more tensions to relax, all our holding have been released. Another way of talking about all this is that each moment of recognition is a momentary recognition of what is true. And part of the practice is to rest in what is true. But to let that resting in what is true become a continuous event for us, not just something we check into periodically. So there's a continuity of being with what's true, continuity of being with what is most deeply true for our hearts. Our hearts are begging us to get begging us for their release. So may each of us grant our hearts its deepest wish, which is for its own release. So may whatever benefit and continuity and concentration and mindfulness that have come from this day practicing together. May whatever patience, self-acceptance, and whatever struggles that we've had here together, may the benefits of all that be shared with those people who we encounter as we leave here, people we go home to or people we drive by on the street, or so that whatever benefits we get from this practice, we freely and completely share with all beings everywhere, so that it's not just for ourselves, but we give it away for the benefit of all beings. May all beings everywhere be happy. Thank you. And before we go,